So the idea that there's a relationship between the Knas and the Chiyuv Ksuba, and that the third parak, the opening Mishnah talking about Knossos, is a relevant theme to all of Masachas Ksubas, because it might be the model for a Chiyuv Ksuba Daraisa, and that the opinion that Chiyuv Ksuba is Daraisa, the Gemara and Daf Yud, is based on Mohar Absulos, that reference in the Torah to the Knas that seems to be shared by the Ones and the Fata situations. And then we saw also the discussion of Mosi Shemra, that if somebody tries to essentially cheat his wife out of the Ksuba money, that there is a, or tries to cheat her in, we won't talk about Ksuba money yet because it's not clear that that's relevant, but he tries to cheat her out of her Basula status, essentially. So we saw that the Ramban thought that that was because he's basically trying to get out of paying this value, whatever it is, and that we consent him by making him pay twice as much, because that's what happens to a ganav and the like. He has to pay extra to correspond to what he tried to do wrong. And therefore, it reflects the fact that there is a basic obligation from the husband to the wife, and that even if you don't say ksuba is daraisa, but maybe they made such an agreement, otherwise why would he want to pull off this plot to begin with? So the notion that this knas, whether it's the onus mefata knas, whether it's the doubling that comes up in Motzi Shemra, all seems to be a payment for her basula status, and that maybe that's what translates into the chiyuv ksuba itself. And I think we mentioned the Pnei Yoshua, for example, who says that even if we say, like probably is the majority view, that ksuba is drabanan, but the ksuba for a mefuta is daraisa, that if a man marries the woman he seduces, so then he divorces her afterwards. If he marries her, he doesn't have to pay the knas. But if he divorces her afterwards, so he does have to pay the ksuba. So the ksuba, which corresponds to the value of the knas, says that would be an obligation daraisa, essentially, because the knas basically got replaced by the marriage. But if he's not married anymore, then he's got to give her the knas. And in that case, the ksuba is daraisa. And so too, the Rambam, if I think I had a chance to see the Rambam, in Hilchas Nairi B'sula, and he says that if somebody is mefata, a woman, if he seduces a woman, so then he has to either marry her or pay the knas. So when he marries her, he writes a ksuba like all the basulos, like basulos in general. So the Nosei Kelim asks, if you saw, well, why is he writing her a ksuba for a basula? She's not a basula, right? She had a relationship with a man before, it happened to be him. She had a relationship with a man before marriage. So some want to suggest that the idea is that really he owes her the knas, so the knas gets converted into the ksuba. So here, even though she's not a psula, she's entitled to this psula knas as a corresponding type of payment. So we also started to discuss the question in general, then how do we view the ksuba? This becomes a very fundamental question, right? Especially the ksuba for a psula, as opposed to a ba'ula, we'll focus on that specifically. So how do you see this obligation? What's the payment there for? So we could say that the payment is there for a type of replacement for her ba'ula status. Right? Ba'ula status is a big asset in getting married. And if she loses that status, it's going to be harder for her to marry somebody else. So perhaps the man, however you want to characterize him, has to pay for that, has to be mashlin for this loss. And we saw the Shita Mekubetzes, right? So that was on the Marma Komos, it seems to sound like that. Or you could say, either differently or alongside of it, like the Rambam says in Mor Nevuchim, that perhaps it is a tashlumin for the wedding itself, for the marriage itself, that there is a economic relationship at the same time as a personal relationship. And therefore, the Rambam uses language like a schar socher, like you have to pay your workers. So too, the economic relationship involves a payment to the wife, and that the ksuba represents that. And again, we wanted to emphasize, as we talked about when we talked about kiddushin, that it doesn't mean a payment for her. You're not buying her. It means that the economic aspects of the relationship, she provides certain economic benefits to the husband. So whether it's her labor that's worth money or whether it's actual resources. And therefore, he correspondingly has chiyuvim to her, and the ksuba represents that as well. So we could say that it represents essentially Dmei Ishus in that sense. And maybe it's a little bit of both. So does that impact on anything, that type of understanding? So it could be. For example, it's interesting, I didn't put this on the Mar Makomos, I probably should have. But the Gemara later on Daf Mem Zayin, look at it together, the Gemara talks about Kvura. That the husband has an obligation, as Mem Zayin Amid Beis, that a husband has to pay for the Kvura of his wife. So the Gemara has the phrase, you see it's in the middle of Mem Zayin Amid Beis, Tana Rabbanan Tiknu Mizonosea Tachas Maise Yadea Ukfurasa Tachas Ksubasa. So Chazal instituted that he has to pay for her burial expenses in exchange, so to speak, for her ksuba. So what does that mean, in exchange for ksuba? What do the words mean? What's that idea? How is he? He's a trade-off for the ksuba, so he is paying the burial expenses. What does that mean?
Sounds like the money that he would normally pay towards her ksuba would instead go into her...
So you could say like that. That's not what Rashi says. Rashi seems to push to a different interpretation. Rashi says, Tachas ksubasa means tachas hanidunya, shechdisolo. The assumption is that there's a value that she brings into the marriage. Let's say she has a dowry from her father she brings into the marriage. So we try to make this kind of equivalent financial arrangement that every value that she brings, he has to bring a value corresponding to it, and vice versa. So she brings money into the relationship, so therefore he should pay for her burial expenses. Right? So Rashi's essentially saying it's not about the ksuba in the sense that we would have thought. The actual ksuba is something else. Hi.
So according to Rashi, if she would have sold her ksuba, then he was still responsible to pay for
it. It would seem like it, yeah, because it's a question, he was selling her ksuba, as we actually haven't had a chance to discuss, brings other issues, right? The question of whether that puts him in violation of the history of being married without a ksuba and whether it creates a bilas nus and other types of issues. But it would seem like, as far as this is concerned, it's not really relevant. Especially because if she would sell a ksuba to somebody else, so then it depends what you mean by selling a ksuba. You know, if he still has a debt to pay, so I have to figure out how that would impact on things. But so Rashi is basically saying it's not about this. Now, there is a view in the Rishonim, this is Rabbeinu Yonason, in the Shita Mekubetzis over here, who says that it is about the ksuba, that in exchange for the 100 or 200 that he would otherwise have to pay, so this is the burial cost. Right? Basically, if she predeceases him, so he ends up saving the ksuba money. Right? He only has to pay out the ksuba if she is divorced by him or if he dies first. So if she dies while they're married, so he saves the ksuba money. So you could have said, it doesn't sound unreasonable, that ksuba, that money, that gets transferred into the kvura instead. The problem is, Tosfos here, you see, rejects that interpretation, maybe for a different reason that we'll talk about a little bit later because it involves a more complicated concept. Very short Tosfos here, Tosfos Furasa. But Tosfos emphasizes Ein Lefarish Tachas Mana Masayin, that we should not get the impression that this is in place of the ksuba money, but rather, like Rashi, it's the Nidunya. So what seems to be bothering Tosfos, in addition to another consideration here that he talks about that we'll come back to, is that the Chi of Ksuba doesn't seem like it's kicked in. Right? If we say that the idea of the Ksuba is Shalotehe Kala Ve'enov Lahotziah, right, that he shouldn't divorce her easily, so then as long as he doesn't divorce her, or he doesn't die, so then there isn't a chiyuv. So why are we now making him pay for burial? What has that got to do with not divorcing? So apparently, this is how some achronim suggest, that's not the only way to view the ksuba. Right, that's a part of the ksuba, but that's not the whole thing. Right? This is a question, for example, there's a sefer, are you familiar with the sefer Chavetzelos HaSharon? Yes? No, it's a very popular sefer nowadays. Just you should be aware of it. There is a classic sefer of Shailos and Tshuvos, classic Acharon, called the Tshuvos Chavetzelos HaSharon. But that's not the sefer I'm talking about. There's a contemporary sefer by a living Machaber called Chavetzelos HaSharon al-Torah. It's written by Mordechai Karlbach. So he has these massive svarim on every chumash of the Torah, sometimes more than one. So for the five chumashim, he has about 7 or 8 volumes. A lot of lumdus in the parsha, a lot of very nice things. So he has some important points about Ksuba in his Sefer and Kiseitze in this past week's parsha. So he discusses the question, what do you think about this? If we say, like the Rambam seems to be saying, that the Ksuba is either Dmei Ishus or Dmei Basulus, either way, right? Either that it's there as some type of payment for the financial value of the marriage, or it's there to compensate her for her loss of her Basulus status. So what does it mean when the Gemara says, Shalot Tehei Kala Be'ena V'Lohotziya? What's the connection then? Right? Doesn't the Gemara tell us the reason for the Ksuba? So what's the connection between one or the other? All right, let's think about that for a second. It's a very important concept as far as this whole Chiyuv Ksuba is involved. Right? What is the significance of the Gemara saying that a Ksuba is there so it shouldn't be too easy to divorce? Right, we discussed a little bit last week that you could see that either as some type of a hashlama of the obligation of marriage, that Chazal are filling in what it means to be married and saying that not only do you have to have kiddushin, but you have to have other obligations towards the wife, and this is one of them. So we could see the drabanan of ksuba as a completion of the Torah's vision. Or maybe we could make a somewhat tenuous case that it's kind of a siag, that there's some isser involved in divorcing your wife without a proper seriousness, without a will. We mentioned the Rambam's, Rabbeinu Gershom's Cherem, and we discussed whether that Cherem is a reflection of the existing Din Dereis or not. So you could say that it's some type of a siag to keep you from doing that. Those were, maybe it's a siag because of Kadesha, right? That maybe this, if there's an Isser of Kadesha, that you shouldn't be too casual about your relationship. So therefore, maybe this is to keep it from being too casual a relationship. So we could see those possibilities. Those are two possibilities within the idea of Shalot Tehei Kala Ve'eina B'Hosia. But if you want to say what we're saying now, what the Rishonim seem to be saying, that it's some type of a payment for the loss of the Psula status, or it's a payment for the financial component of the marriage, either way, do either of those have anything to do with Shalot Tehei Kala Ve'eina B'Hosia? How do we reconcile what the Gemara says with that idea? Any thoughts? Well, you could say, and again, this is something that the Chavetz Chaim discusses, you could say that, I should also emphasize, by the way, I like mentioning many Achronish names. I don't expect everyone to remember them necessarily, so it shouldn't be a pressure. I think it's important to say Davar B'Shem Omro, you know, want to give proper credit where credit is due. I also think it's interesting to talk about the rabbinic literature, but it doesn't mean that you have to feel like it's an obligation to remember every Shita and Achronim. So,
what about Rav Nassim
Kishtari? You have to know. No, but even his name as well. That you know, take it as a possible enhancement, but you know, that's not necessarily something you have to focus on. But the point is that you could say that it's two separate tracks. That Chazal were motivated to make a ksuba shlote hei kalabeinu b'hotziya. That's why they got involved in the ksuba business. They said, we have to have the ksuba because we want to have that protection. Once we have that, now what form does it take? How do we decide how much it is? How do we dictate its terms? So we could say that Chazal created an obligation of the meishus, or they also corresponded to the notion of the psula knas, that they took certain concepts that had relevance in the context of marriage and created a marriage contract. A marriage contract means that it's going to correspond to these elements. But why is it there in the first place? It's there in the first place, shalot tehei kala be'eina v'lohotziya. That's one possible way to look at it. Alternatively, not radically differently, it could also be that maybe the ksuba has a couple of components, right? Maybe that statement refers to something else. That maybe ksuba has the benefit that it shouldn't be too casual to get divorced. That's true. And this is also true. Right? That maybe we have two components, which is going to lead us to a question that we want to try to understand a little bit more. We'll talk about in a few minutes. But basically, all of this is just very important to try to understand what is a ksuba about? What exactly are we trying to accomplish in the ksuba, And what role does it have? So it could be, to go back to this question of Kavura, so you could say that Lamaisa, even though they're not going to have the issue now of getting divorced, now she died, so it's not relevant. But Lamaisa created a Dmei Ishus, it created a obligation for the marriage itself, and therefore the Kavura is connected to that. So maybe that view that the Rishonim have, the Rishonim other than the Rishonim on the Daf, other than Rashi and Tosfos, but Rabbeinu Yonason's view, maybe reflects the fact that there is this Dmei Yishus obligation, and therefore the Ksuba is a part of that, the Kavura rather is a part of that. So that seems to be a possibility. Now, it's interesting, just in terms of Arusa, so Tosfos happens here to mention Arusa. Now we saw, probably the first week we mentioned that we are working off the assumption that a ksuba is something that goes together with nisuin. That the ksuba is not really something that kedushin involves. That kedushin is the first step, and that once there's nisuin, there needs to be a ksuba. But you recall that we also did mention that there were rishonim who say that there is an obligation of a ksuba for a arusa as well. Right, that even a woman who's just had kiddushin does have to have a ksuba. So the Sefer Hafla is a classic Acharon on Ksubas. It's an important Sefer. He wrote two Sfarim, Sefer Hamakne on kiddushin and Sefer Hafla on Ksubas. So the Hafla writes that even those Rishonim who say that there is a ksuba for a arusa, that's for sure the Rabbanan. That the ksuba that we talk about that might be daraisa, that's only for an asur. But if there's a ksuba for an arusa, that's for sure drabban. So it could be suggested, again, the Sefer Chavetz HaSharon discusses along those lines as well, it could be suggested that this reflects a different consideration, that Chazal were also worried, shlo tehekala beinav lehotziya. So Chazal said that you have to have a ksuba for that purpose. But separate from that, there is the idea of Dmei Ishus and Dmei Psula. So you might come to the conclusion that when you have a Psula who is entering into Nisuin, entering into full marriage, then you have a deraisa concept of ksuba to whatever extent. And on a separate track, you also have a concept of Shalot HaKala Beino Vlotzia. And that applies to non-basulas, and it applies also even maybe before Nisuan, even just to Eris.
So technically a woman can receive 10 basula, like 10 ksubas that are basulas, so she's divorced before the Kiddushin sets in every time?
So that's actually an interesting question. So just a parenthetical, we'll address that because you're bringing it up. So it's an interesting question. So let's say, if you say the basula is for the purpose, the basula money is for the purpose of corresponding to Knas. So what's the story about a Knas? Let's say you have a woman who's married, she has Kiddushin, and she doesn't have full Nisuin. So let's what would the question be like that? You know, so let's ask that question. So a woman goes through Kiddushin, doesn't actually have a physical relationship with her husband, she gets divorced, and now somebody rapes her. So is there a Knas? Is there a status of Psula? So this was actually a machlokas between the commentaries on the Mishnayos and the third parak of Ksubas, in parak Gimel Mishnah Gimel, that according to the Tosfos Yontif, there is no knas after that point. That since she was married, so there's no knas. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger over there says, "What do you mean she's a psula? The Torah says psula, so who cares? She happens to have been married, but Lamai says she's a psula." So that presumably would correspond to your question, because if we say that the chiyuv psula in the ksuba is to correspond to the knas, so then whatever the story is by the knas should reflect itself here. So that all goes again to the question, if we say that it's about the knas, so then we also have to wonder, what's the knas about? It's the Arsameach. The Arsameach, if you're familiar with Meir Simcha of Dvinz, classic commentary on the Rambam, the Arsameach writes in Hilchos Nayar Besula that the idea of Knas for a basula, he thinks you could understand it in two ways. You could say that either it's there because the ma'anes took away her hod, so to speak, her kava, took away her special status as a basula, which is relevant to her future marriage prospects, and therefore the knas is to correspond to that. Or, he says, you could say that maybe it has to do with kadesha, that we don't want people to be casual about their relationships, whether they're consensual or non-consensual. So we don't want them to be casual about their consensual relationships. You have to have kiddushin and the like. And the non-consensual relationships get penalized monetarily, that we have whatever safeguard there is, all goes to the same idea that there shouldn't be a kadesha component to our relationships. It's funny if you say that way, because you mentioned the Rambam actually had suggested that the whole issue of kadesha is a little bit exacerbated by the knas, because the knas makes it seem like you could pay for the relationship, and that's why he says you need the lav of kadesha. But either way, it's still possibly true. So that could then address the question of, so what makes somebody a basula or not a basula? So if they're married but they're not a basula anymore, or they're married but they're still a basula rather, so then is there knas? That's machlokas. So also machlokas rishonim, what if there is ma'anes that doesn't take away her psula status? Let's say, for example, it was via shaloka darka, or it's what the Gemara calls harab, which means that it was just a tchilas bia, but it didn't actually complete the act. So that was an achlokas rishonim. Rashi and Sanhedrin and Dafayim Gimel, I'll give you these makoros later if you want to look them up tomorrow. I probably should add in a few more things that I hadn't given you to see. So Rashi writes that if there's no actual breaking of the psula in the act of onus, that there is no knas. While Tosfos and Yevamos, Tosfos disagrees. So all of this goes to the question a little bit of what exactly is creating the knas. So we could say that whatever it is that creates the knas, that all gets built into the ksuba, and therefore the ksuba reflects that with its concern about psula, with its differentiation between a basula and a non-basula. And the whole institution of Shalotah Hekala Be'enav L'Hotzia then really would come to be a different track. That even though the Gemara says that's there, that could be a concern midrabanan, right? Especially if you believe Ksuba is Daraisa. Right? According to the opinion of the Gemara and the minority of Rishonim who say Ksuba is Daraisa, so you have to reconcile the language of Tiknu Chachamim Kidei Shalot Hekala Ve'enav Lotzia. So maybe it's two different tracks. That Min HaTorah there is a certain obligation which stems from the Psula status. And Midrabanan there's an institution of Shalot Hekala Ve'enav Lotzia. This is a little bit complicated. Is everybody following? I know we've been integrating a lot of different parts here. So we'll definitely go over it again in a few minutes. But is everyone following, more or less? Any questions? This is a little bit complicated. So that element of Shalot Hekala Ve'enav L'Hotzia, so that's simply a monetary penalty, essentially, right? Basically, not in the Torah sense of Knas, but basically it's a monetary disincentive. So you could argue that only kicks in once there is a divorce. But the component of the Dmei Ishus, of the Dmei Psula, so that really is going on during the marriage. So you could say that Kvura represents that. But, you see, Tosus here, the part that I didn't read yet, it's a Tosus, the short Tosus. Tosus says, well, how could it have anything to do with Ksuba? Darusa ain la Kvura. Right? That if she's just undergone Kedushin, she hasn't undergone Nisuin, so then there isn't actually a Din of Kvura. So Tosus here seems to be assuming that there is a Ksuba with Darusa, and yet she's not getting Kvura. So how could you say that when the Gemara says Ksuba, it means the actual Ksuba document? So it could be that, no, the Ksuba for Darusa is just Shalot Hekala Be'enav L'Hotzia, that he shouldn't divorce her too easily. So therefore, that's a different din. That's not going to bring with the Chi of Kvura. But if they're actually married, then Ksuba means, the Dmei Ishus means the recognition of the value of the marriage. So that does bring with it a chiyuv kvura, and that could be what it means. Okay, again, please don't hesitate to ask questions, because this is complicated, but I will go over it all again in a second. So this also could lead to a few other interesting things. It's interesting, Chavetzel Sasharin again mentions, that there is a machlokas. It's happens to be a very practical question. It's surprising that it's a machlokas. Really, in the later svarim, you'd think this is the most kosher thing. But a divorce, you have a get. So does a get need a bezdin? So you think this is the kind of thing that's got to be beferish in the Torah, right? This is such a major element of how this happens. Nowadays, we use a bezdin for a get, but is that really a maker or a dinner requirement? So if you learn the first Mishnah in Sanhedrin and the Rashi's, it's not so pashut with that there's a chiyuv get, there's a chiyuv bezdin for a get. So what he wants to suggest is as follows, that what exactly is a get, right? So a get parallels, the get doesn't undo the nisuin, because you would need a get even if you just had kedusha. So a get is there to undo kedusha. So you need a bezdin if you have mishpat, essentially if you have a monetary relationship that's being addressed. So is there a monetary relationship at the stage of kedusha, or just only at nisuin? So perhaps you could say that even if you say that there is a ksuba at kedusha, that doesn't really reflect an actual monetary relationship. That's essentially a disincentive penalty that he shouldn't come to divorce her too easily. So you don't need a bezdin to address that penalty. The idea that you would need a bezdin is if there was a real monetary relationship, there's a real mishpat, then that's only one that comes with the actual nisuin, with the actual marriage. Okay, so what emerges is that when we talk about shalot heikala v'enav lahotzia, so that is a din d'rabbanan, as the Gemara says, shalot heikala, tiknu chachamim, that's a din d'rabbanan. That's basically just a monetary disincentive. But there could be another whole track here that is maybe daraisa, or at least arguably daraisa, that either corresponds to the basula status and therefore is unique to the basula, or reflects a dmeishas for the whole relationship. And especially, we know that the Gemara, we saw the Gemara in Daf Yud, that even the opinion there that says that ksuba is daraisa, so that the conclusion of the Gemara is that only the ksuba for basula is deraisa, and the ksuba for a almana is derabbanan according to everyone. So that could possibly create the suggestion that really we have two completely separate components here. That midaraisa, there's one type of ksuba, and that midarabbanan, it's a whole other issue of shlota hekala be'enav lahotzia. There is a Tosfos, which I'll also maybe have you look at tomorrow. Tosfos on Daf Lamed Tes. That Tosfos addresses the question that if the whole issue is that we're afraid he's going to divorce her too casually, so then you might say, well, so then why do we also impose it if he dies? We're trying to disincentivize him against dying. So hopefully he's disincentivized enough already, right? So it's not going to be that the super value is going to be what's going to stop him. Right, so what exactly is the idea of the almana in that context? So Tosfos suggests that it's mishum chein, basically, that we want that the woman should be desirable to other men after she is an almana, or that she should be interested in getting married in the first place. So therefore, for an almana as well, we create a financial advantage either way, either that it should make the whole marriage more desirable to her in the first place, or it should make her now a little wealthier so that she's more eligible. But it's not the ikar reason. That the ikar ksuba is there because of the concern of divorce. And once we did that, so it's also relevant to an almana because of this extra component. But all of that is on this track, midrabban. So therefore, this creates the question, which I think is going to be very relevant as we see the beginning of the second parak tomorrow, that perhaps there really are two separate chiyuvim. Right? We have to figure out, this is a question I want you to keep in mind as you see the Gemaras tomorrow, that what is the nature of the chiyuv ksuba as far as distinguishing between basula and the non-basula? Right? That's going to be the major issue if you've seen the Mishnah. Right? So essentially that's the major struggle. The husband is saying, I only owe you a non-basula ksuba, I only owe you 100. And the wife is saying, no, I was a psula. You owe me 200. Which, by the way, parenthetically, is much more than a 2-to-1 ratio in real life. Because the difference between a daraisa and drabanan could also end up to impact on how the money is evaluated. So for more machmir on the ksuba daraisa concept and the ksuba b'msula, it could also translate to how the value is calculated, and it could end up actually being a very significant difference, not just the 2-to-1 difference that it sounds like. But whatever it is, so...
Isn't there an actual amount written on the ketubah nowadays?
Not on all the ksubas. Maybe Sephardi ksubas are an actual amount. That's what they're writing the Tosefos ksuba. Usually they write an actual amount for the Tosefos ksuba.
Because
the amount for the ksuba itself is going to change, probably dependent on various other factors.
One of my rabbis in Israel went to, I think it was Eliyahu's, one of the weddings that he officiated at.
Which would be a Sephardi wedding.
It would be a Sephardi wedding, and they needed someone to quickly tell them the exchange rate because they had written in dollars or something and needed to write in shekels.
For the ksuba itself or for the Tosefos ksuba? Because it happens to be that it's true that the Sephardi ksubas and the ksubas in Eretz Yisrael in general, they do put a dollar amount in the Tosefos, and then everyone listens more carefully during the reading of the ksuba because now they're interested in what it actually says. But that part is true. As far as translating the value of the Ikka ksuba, I'm not sure if they do that. But either way, you know, that's a whole discussion how to figure that out. So it could be a very substantial difference, the difference between... You think 2-to-1 is already substantial, but could be even more substantial than that, the difference between a b'sula ksuba and a non-b'sula ksuba. So one question I think it's worth keeping in mind as we see the Mishnah tomorrow is, what is the relationship between a b'sula ksuba and a non-b'sula ksuba? Are they essentially the same thing? Right? Should we say that basically either there is a concept of payment for the marriage or a takana not to make divorce too easy, as it really applies to both. And just the ksuba b'sula, okay, b'sula is considered to be more marriageable, so she gets a little bit more. It's considered to be as if Kiilu, the husband, had a more valuable deal, so to speak. So the number is higher. Or are they really fundamentally different documents? Right, that the ksuba for a b'sula is really built on certain concepts unique to the b'sula. The ksuba for a non-b'sula is really a whole different institution. It's really there as a different concern. And therefore, when the husband and wife argue about this, are they really coming from two completely different places? And are they really asserting two completely different things? So I think that's going to be an important question to keep in mind as we talk about this clash of Ne'amanus in this clash of claims that we're going to see in the Mishnah tomorrow. Question?
When a man dies nowadays, especially in America, I know Israel is a little different, but she is the Yorish, right? Are there any ramifications of the ksuba itself, because she's getting all the money anyway?
Yeah, because his kids are really the Yorish. You know, that if he has sons.
But I'm saying in American law, doesn't like all the money go to the wife.
American law, maybe, but then American law, the relationship between American law and halacha is complicated. You know, theoretically, we're assuming, or way more than theoretically, we assume that the halacha's definition of Yerusha should really take priority. So that's what's supposed to happen. I mean, now there's a concept that's a much longer tangential discussion, but just discuss it for a second. No, it's important to understand that there is a concept of a halachic will, and there is a concept of the Torah's will, and there's the concept of secular will. So basically, the Torah has rules for Yerusha. It says what should happen, B'chor Kishnai, and the whole story. And really, strictly speaking, it's really only the sons who inherit, if there are sons. And secular law, obviously, has a very different perspective. So when an observant person is worried about their will, so usually they want something in practice closer to the secular version, that they want their daughters to inherit also, they want the other family members to be taken care of also. So, you know, it relates a little bit to the question Akiva was asking. We're dealing with a little bit of a different social reality today. So there is what's known as a halachic will, which is kind of a complicated maneuver where the husband, or whoever it is, the father, the person dying, agrees to give a certain sum through kind of a complicated arrangement that basically is a chov created the other family members that they get released from if they agree to follow the instructions as laid out in the will. It's a complicated setup, but basically it has to be addressed. So what very often could happen, which very often does happen in real life, unfortunately, is if these things are not addressed beforehand. So, in general, they always tell you before halacha comes into it that it's important to have a will, because otherwise what you want doesn't happen and whatever the government thinks should happen is what happens. But when the halachic part gets involved also, so you could theoretically, let's say you have a man who has sons and daughters, and the sons are religious and the daughters aren't religious, or they'll decide their view once they see what they end up better, which could also happen, right? So then you have a huge fight, right? You have the daughter saying that according to secular law, we're entitled to the property and it's ours, and according to halacha, the boys will say, no, the sons are really the inheritors, and it's a huge fight. And you know, it's not really a situation anybody wants, so that's something to try to address beforehand. So theoretically, this could happen in a scenario also, that you know, the halacha might have a different view of what should happen to the estate, but you're right, maybe the American law might say that she...
It's pretty standard, though, like nowadays.
So that's also something
to...
Really,
survive, you know,
so that's also something to... I don't know if that's... She's the full inheritor, if there are children.
Is
that the law?
I think in America, because I know we have...
She's the full inheritor?
There's problems with, you know, every family.
Everywhere,
so.
But then, but the children completely are cut out?
I think so.
Why would that be?
In American law?
Yeah.
I think if one of the spouses are alive, I think it could...
Inherit everything?
Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure.
Okay, we have to figure that out. But either way, that's one of the many potentials where you could have... In general, the overlap between secular law and religious law in this case is also relevant another way, because if the court charges alimony, let's say if there's divorce, so if the court imposes alimony on the husband, so then the alimony also could end up being more than the ksuba, and then you don't have to pay ksuba and the alimony. So the chiyuv ksuba only becomes relevant when there's no alimony. If there is alimony, alimony could end up eliminating the whole ksuba. So the interaction between secular law and halacha, whether we're talking about a death or a divorce, could end up impacting how these whole things play out.
I know we're getting more farther afield, but there are cases nowadays where the wife has to pay the husband alimony.
Right.
And how would that work? Let's say in ksuba, would he have to refuse the money and pay her? Or
maybe he has to do both. Maybe he could pay the...
He can accept, but also pay out basically from the same amount of money.
Yeah, presumably he should be able to accept. He may still have the chiyuv ksuba, right? So you have to subtract from the ksuba. I don't know if there's a reason why we would say that he wouldn't be allowed to accept.
Perhaps, because the whole point is to give money to the woman. She's giving him money.
Right, but maybe that depends. So let's say, in general, let's say the court wasn't involved, right? But let's say the woman decides. And let's say you have a Jewish couple, and the woman decides, I'm very wealthy, and thanks for the memories, and I want to give my husband $1 million. Right, so would there be a problem with that? Probably not. Right, she could also be mochel, which would be okay. That's in the case with the alimony, she probably won't be mochel. But theoretically, it would seem like you could have both. That he should pay her out of that, and she could pay him. But the point of whether or not there's alimony at all affects definitely the chiyuv ksuba, because if the court is imposing alimony that's more than ksuba, then you won't have to pay. But if there's no alimony at all, let's say, you don't have to pay that. And maybe even if there is alimony in his direction, you might still have to pay, presumably. Okay. So I think I want to review everything now quickly in the next few minutes, so just to make sure we have a kind of holistic picture of everything. But any other questions? Do we have a basic understanding of our introduction to this whole concept so that we feel ready to see the sugya itself tomorrow? Any questions? All right, so let's try to go over all the basic details just so we have kind of a holistic picture. So we discussed that there is a concept of kiddushin. According to the Rambam, there's a mitzvah of Kiddushin. According to the Sefer HaChinuch, there's a mitzvah of Kiddushin. There are Tva who understands the mitzvah of Kiddushin, and that's why we recite Birchas HaMitzvah according to him at the marriage itself. And the mitzvah of Kiddushin, the way the Rambam understands it, is that we should have a serious relationship, that we shouldn't get involved in a physical relationship casually. And indeed, the Rambam says that there's an Issa Daraisa, the other Rishon didn't necessarily agree, but the Rambam felt there's an Issa Daraisa of Kadesha for a person to be involved in a physical relationship without the benefit of Kedushin. And he discussed also in Mor Nevuchim some of the added benefits that we don't want unstable families, and we don't want a situation where a man will have children and children won't know who the father is, or a woman will have children from many different men, all kinds of reasons why it's not ideal to have pregnancies in such a context. So therefore, for that and other reasons, the Torah said it's a good idea to have the institution of marriage, and the Rambam understands the mitzvah deraisa in that sense. And he also wrote in the Sefer HaMitzvos that the existence of knas that we find for mafata and then for ma'anes, so that makes the isser even more important, because one might get the idea that because there is something to pay, that makes it sound like, okay, as long as you pay, you can do whatever you want, which makes it more prostitution-like, makes it more kadesha-like. So therefore, all the more so, the Torah had to, in the same breath, kind of emphasize that there's an isser kadesha, even though there's a concept of knas, and therefore we have this mitzvah of kedushin. Distinction from, let's say, the Rosh understands that it's not a specific mitzvah, but that there is a hechsher mitzvah for the other mitzvah of puruvu. So we have this notion of kedushin, and it sounds like from the Gemara and the Mishnah in the first daf in kedushin, and the Gemara over there as well, that we have three methods of kedushin that can be used, and that the purpose of kedushin is that she should be sanctified like hekdesh, that you should dedicate, that there should be a designation, an exclusive designation, just like hekdesh. We saw that Tosfos there says that this language wouldn't work when you're buying something. It's not the same kind of concept. It's about this type of designation. And the Mishnah says clearly that there are three types of methods you could use. Kesef, Shtar, Ubiya. So nowadays we only use Kesef. As we mentioned, Bia is theoretically possible, but the Gemara says it's very inappropriate, and that's essentially usher to do it that way, even though it would work, and that shtar is not the ksuba. Ksuba is something else. Shtar would be theoretically if one would write a contract similar to a reverse get, but nowadays we don't really use that. And we use kesef in the form of shava kesef, in the form of a ring, and that constitutes the kedushin, which creates this designation. We spent some time discussing as well that the fact that we use a kinyan for kedushin should not be interpreted, at least as we understood it, as one buying the woman, but that the nature of the kinyan is simply an act of seriousness, that we find that we use the method of kinyan to convey seriousness. So when you want to buy something, you want to transfer property, so you need an expression of seriousness. And so too, if you want to enter into a marriage relationship, so you need seriousness. So we use the two to teach each other. But if we want an expression of seriousness, you look at the world of Kinyanim, that's what teaches us how we convey seriousness, what type of methods do that, and we transfer those methods over to Kedushin. We mentioned some other indications that it's not a Kinyan on the woman, it's a solidification of the relationship. So for example, we mentioned the question that Rishonim asked, why don't we do Hagbah? Why don't you lift the woman up, carry her over the threshold? Let that be the Kenyan. So the Rishonim say, because you're not being kone at her, it's not the nature of the Kenyan. You don't have a chetzah that you can lift up. And we mentioned also the machlokis, the taz and the sma, about the general nature of Kenyan kesef. When you pay money, let's say, to buy a house, you make a Kenyan with a coin. So is that a down payment? Is it some degree of kesef shivyon, is this some element of the worth of the house? Or do we say, no, it's completely symbolic and has nothing at all to do with the worth. It's not even a quarter of $1 million, quarter, 25 cents of $1 million that you ultimately owe for the house. And the Sma made the point that it can't be a kesef shivyon against the taz, because if we use it for kedushin, that shows you it's not at all about the value, it's only about a symbolism. And since it's the same kinyan kesef, that's got to be the way it works. So in any event, so we discussed that about what kedushin is, and then we saw that there's another level called nisuin, and that nisuin seems to be really the completion of the household relationship, that kedushin is the designation, and that nisuin is what brings the woman into the household completely. The Gemara mentions that it has nafkaminas for certain dinim, such as latamba, yarsho, hafra, nidra, that he inherits her property, that he would be metamei for her if he was a kohen and she died, and that he can annul her vows that are relevant to him. And we saw that it's somewhat surprising that even though when it comes to Kiddushin, so the Mishnah is very clear in telling you what the methods of Kiddushin are, but Chazal never really take the time to tell us what Nisuin is. So we saw that there are a number of different opinions in the Rishonim as to what constitutes Nisuin, and Halach L'maisa, we try to incorporate as many as possible of them into our modern day marriage ceremonies. So what do they include? Practically speaking, they include standing under the chuppah itself as some type of symbolic rishus of the chasen, yichud, it was the Rambam's view, the badekin, that was also a possibility, eating a meal, the chuppah, making the brachas, that whole story. So all of these we integrate into our marriage ceremony, even though it's a little bit unwieldy in that some of them take place before the Kiddushin, and one would have thought that Kiddushin should be first by definition, first you dedicate her to the relationship and then you bring her into the household, but apparently, at least theoretically, it's possible to have it the other way around. So at least for the parts that we don't necessarily think is the strongest candidate for Nisuin, i.e. the Badekin, we're not worried about having that before the Kiddushin itself. And the whole question of whether or not you need Eidim for any part of this, and whether you need Eidim for the Badekin, all of that goes to this question as well. And we discussed that until the Nisuin takes place, so the husband and wife are usher to each other, there's an Isser Arusa. The Isser Arusa is probably the Rabbanan. The Ravid, there is a view in Rishonim, the Ravid in the Shita Mekubetz says that the Isser is Daraisa. But most Rishonim, including the Rambam, seems to see it as a Isser Darabanan. But it's an Isser Darabanan that we advertise at the wedding itself, because part of the bracha that's recited under the chuppah is Asher Tzivanu al Arayis v'Asa lanu es Arusos. We announce that the Arusos are prohibited, even if it's a prohibition of Darabanan. And we discussed why that prohibition exists. We mentioned Rav Moshe Feinstein's fascinating tshuva, appropriately in Orach Chaim, where he compares it, discusses the Gemara's comparison, the Yerushalmi's comparison, that somebody who eats matzah on Erev Pesach is compared to Bo'ol Arusos of the Beis Chamav, and that there the Rambam explains, not the Rambam, the Rav Moshe explains the nature of the comparison. He says that we have to figure out what exactly is the Isser Arusa, why is there such an Isser Drabanan? So he gave two possibilities. One possibility is that it's because of the Isser Pnuya, because of the Isser Kadesha. Pnuya meaning a single woman, but the Rambam's assumption that a unmarried woman, unmarried man, it's Nisr Daraisa to be together. So because of that Isser, that might be why there's an Isser Arusa. And we saw two ways to understand that. Either it's because we really think somebody might come to be with a Pnuya because they think it's not so important to have a marriage, or because of this whole Isser Kadesha, the Torah is saying that you have to have a certain level of commitment in order to be together. And this is not enough commitment. So Chazal filled out the picture that not only do you have to be committed with Kiddushin, you have to be committed with Nisuin. We mentioned also Rav Aaron Cutler's point that you might say that Taka would make more sense to say then that Arusa should be also Daraisa. That if you, the Rambam says you have an Isser Kadesha, if you don't have full commitment to the woman, if you don't have full commitment without Nisuin, so why don't we say that should also be Asa Daraisa? That should also be a part of the Isser Kadesha. It's Taka surprising that it's only an Isser Drabanan. So to that, we mentioned Ron Cutler's suggestion that since it is expected that one who has Kiddushin will then have Nisuin, that's the first Sugging Subis that we didn't see, the Daf Beis, the first Mishnah Subis, that ultimately there is an assumption that the Chiyuvim, the responsibilities of Nisuin, kicks in after a certain period of time. So that maybe that's enough to say it's not a Kadesha, that if he has designated her with Kedushin and the expectation is he will now eventually have to fully marry her, so then on a Daraisa level that might be enough. And Chazal then said, no, you can't have the physical relationship until this is actually done. Rav Moshe in his tshuva mentioned another possibility, that more creative possibility, one that works better with the comparison to matzah, that the idea is that Chazal wanted that the first physical relationship between the husband and wife should be a bias mitzvah, should be one where there is a full obligation to the wife of Ona. And even though outside of that, so it would still be a rishus, it wouldn't be an avera, But Chazal didn't want that to be the first physical relationship. So therefore, there's an Issa D'Rabbanan, and that being the first physical relationship, there shouldn't be an active bia until there actually is full nisuah. So that's a more creative interpretation, but it works better with the idea that there's a comparison to matzah, that Chazal wanted that the first taste of matzah that you have on Pesach season, around Pesach time, should be the matzah's mitzvah. So therefore, even though throughout the rest of Pesach you'll have matzah as a reshus, but the first bite should be matzah's mitzvah, so to have any on Erev Pesach when the matzah's mitzvah hasn't kicked in would be an Isser, which would really be comparable in that sense to the Isser Arusa. So with that, so we discussed a little bit this whole question then of what Nisuin involves and what this Isser is, and how the Chiyuv Ksuba corresponds. And we saw that the Chiyuv Ksuba is, according to most Rishonim, the Rabbanan, but there is an opinion of the Gemara and the minority view of the Rishonim, Tosfos, that Ksuba is Daraisa. And the idea that it's Daraisa is traced to the Pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim, which corresponds to the Pasuk in Parshas Kisetze, that the penalty for a Ma'anis and a Mefata is referred to in the Torah, Kemohar HaPsulos, like the value, like the dowry of a psula. And the question then is the Torah just referring to this existing, or is it actually validating it as a chiyuv? As we mentioned, it's hard to say that it's not at least on some level endorsing it. It's certainly not discouraging it. So at least in a very low level, the Torah is certainly recognizing it as not only an existing concept, but a concept that's worth upholding, if not as an actual chiyuv. And we saw that the whole question of what's Daraisa and what's Darabanan is somewhat of a fluid concept. That there are those who hold Darabanan and those who hold Daraisa, and those who hold that the concept is Daraisa, the number is Darabanan, or the other way around. You know, that is some, it's basically some type of progression from some Daraisa concept to a Darabanan version. And we mentioned also the Chassam Sofer, that it was an example of Masar HaKasav B'Chachamim, that Chazal were given the authority to decide how this mitzvah deraisa should play out. But whatever it is, essentially this becomes an obligation, which most Rishonim say is part of Nisuin rather than part of Kiddushin, even though it is a Machlokas Rishonim, as we mentioned earlier today. And on the side of the page of the Rambam, the Beis Yosef, they quote Rishonim and say the other way. Morty? Chassam Sofer, he says that this is an example of, where is it? In the commentaries, Kiddushin Tuxuvas, on the Daf Yud. That it's an example of Mas. Should I explain it again? Just say where it is. Should I say it again?
No, not again.
Okay. So in any event, it represents this whole fluid relationship. There's some degree of Daraisa and there's some degree of Darabanan. And then we discussed also, so we talk about this being a Darabanan, so what do we mean by it's a Darabanan? Is it a knat? Is it a siag? Is it a safeguard? Doesn't sound like it, right? It sounds like we're talking about a different kind of Drabbanan, a Drabbanan where the Torah gives a certain first step, and Chazal intuit that there's more to the picture, and they fill in the rest of the picture, and therefore the Torah wants that there should be responsibilities towards the wife, and the Chazal spelled out more clearly and more specifically what exactly that entails and how the back and forth goes with that. We said that it could possibly be seen as a siag, that either you could say it's a siag in the sense that Kadesha is alive, and this is all a part of the whole Isser Kadesha, that we shouldn't have a casual relationship. So it all goes to that Isser Kadesha. We noted that the Rambam's language in Sefer HaMitzvahs is actually Kadesha, that one should not be boel without Kiddushin and Ksuba, which raises the whole question of Ksuba's Drabbanan, which the Rambam does hold. So how does he include that in the mitzvah deraisa? I mentioned some suggestions that it's not really a reference to the ksuba document, it's a reference to sher ksusa ona, something like that. A couple of other suggestions. But you could maybe call this the knas in the sense that you shouldn't have too casual a relationship. We also mentioned that there's a cherem Rabbeinu Gershom, that one should not divorce his wife, bal korcha, one should not divorce his wife against her will. So we talked a little bit about the fact that a cherem could be either seen as a new iser, or could be seen as an enforcement of an existing Torah prohibition. So if we assume that there is some Torah prohibition of divorcing against the wife's will, so then maybe this is all a version of that, that this is all essentially Chazal strengthening that point, and that's when we get to the statement of Shelo Tehe Kala Be'ena V'Hotzia, that the Ksuba is identified with that idea. So we discussed the Maisa Chazal say that if one exists in a marriage without the Ksuba, so In one sense, they call that a bilas nus. They also phrase that as an iser. It's also to be mishahed isha without the ksuba. And we discussed a little bit what the nature of that iser is. Is it an iser to have bia specifically, or is it an iser even to have yichud, like the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam say that the iser is on yichud, and not just on bia, but that also leads the question of. Should you say more than that? Should you say it's also to be married at all? That was the view of the Dvar Yehoshua against the Sav Merav. And the question of, so Lamaisa, if there's an Issa Yichud, is an Issa Yichud by itself because that represents marriage, or is it an Issa Yichud because really it's about an Issa Bia, but if there's an Issa Bia, then we have to have an Issa Yichud also, which is not so pashut if you're talking about a couple that's already been married. And then we talked about how this is an important question, because it affects, first of all, at what point does the ksuba have to be written? What does it have to be there before? We talked about a little bit how that affects the question of dating on the ksuba when the day is a Ganesh Mashal's type of wedding. What do we need the ksuba to be there for? Is it there for the yichud? Is it there for the chuppah? Is it there for bia? What's it there for? And that's also relevant if you have married couples, been married for a long time, but they lose their ksuba, so now they're in a state without a ksuba. So what are they not allowed to do? That's an important question. And then also, how do you deal with it? So a married couple could write a new ksuba, or theoretically, you could give her a mashkon. If it's not Shabbos, he could write out a check. That might be the simplest way. And we discussed also that there are some other kulas when the couple's been married already. The fact that the yeschaivus was done in front of Aiden, that's also perhaps helps a little bit. And also the Rama has a statement that nowadays we're a little bit less makbid on the whole thing, because if the idea is that you shouldn't divorce your wife bal karcha, so nowadays that we already have a cherem rabbeinu gershom that can't happen, or rather shlo teh kal b'ein avlotzia, so therefore it's less of a need to have a ksuba. But the Rama does write that still the minig is not to be making like this, but theoretically it could be a snif l'hakel, that the concern of easy divorce is not as much of a concern nowadays as it was in the time of Chazal. So then essentially today, we try to isolate a few more points about this and to try to figure out, so what does the ksuba represent? Does the ksuba represent the obligation towards the husband to the wife for the marriage itself? You might call it me'ishus, or maybe it represents the fact that he took away her b'sula and that's going to affect her marriageability afterwards if he dies or if they get divorced. And that's the nature of the chiyuv. And what does that do about the fact that Chazal have already pointed to the factor of shlo teh kala b'ein av lahotziya? So we noted the suggestion that it could be that there's two different elements. The ksuba is made up of a couple of different parts, the dmei ishus and also the disincentive to get divorced. Or it could be that it's all about the disincentive, but Chazal then said, okay, to disincentivize you, we'll create a marriage contract, the Me'ishas, and that's the form that it took. So we discussed a little bit how that impacts on other aspects of the relationship, the fact that Chiyuv Kvura, which the Gemara says is to parallel the Ksuba, but most Rishonim say not the actual Ksuba, it's a reference to the dowry, but there is a view that it's the Ksuba itself. We discussed a little bit how that plays in. And then we talked about other implications of saying there's two tracks, that there is a din of Shalot Hekala Ve'ena of L'Hotziya, which is a din derabanan, and that could apply certainly to a non-Besula, and could apply even to an Arusa, maybe, that if we say, according to those Rishonim, that there is the Ksuba for an Arusa, maybe it's about that. But that's not a full-fledged ksuba obligation. And Hafla says that's definitely Durabanan, according to everyone. And we discussed how those two concepts could play off against each other. We talked about the idea of the Dmei Psula being a big factor in why the Psula gets the number that she gets, and how that factors into various considerations, especially that's the heart of the idea that ksuba is derais, according to the opinions that say that it is. And then that essentially got us to the question of how these two different components come together, and leaves us at the door of Perek Sheni with this question, that do we say that ksuba is one idea representing the agreement between the two parties? Is the ksuba of a besula essentially the same as the ksuba of a non-besula, just it's a higher number? Or is it a completely different document? Does it represent a completely different reality? And how exactly does the factor of Shalot Tehe Kala B'Einav L'Hotziya manifest itself on a different level. So those are some of the questions that we're essentially left with as we enter into the second parak. So is that clear? Any questions about that? Any issues? Anything you can clarify? And some of that's a little bit complicated. So if there's anything that repeat, happy to do so. Okay, so then we'll stop here and we'll head to the Beis Medrash for Mincha. Wish everyone a wonderful, fantastic day in all ways. And again, please, a very strong encouragement tomorrow morning especially.